Warning.
This is the most important
podcast
of our lifetime.
Hello, everyone.
What is Hoppatarian?
So what is Hoppa? So when you put together Hoppatarians, what is that?
You know the thing.
They're here to awkward it up for you guys.
Which is a very interesting and beautiful mix of humanity.
Anyone has a podcast?
You're an extremist.
Shut up!
All right, let's get to it.
Hey, what's happening? And welcome to the Hoppatarian Show, the number one podcast hosted by two people who aren't good at math and can't speak English right. Please don't forget to subscribe, leave a five-star rating, and in the comments, tell us how much you love the Hoppa Ethno State. Our guest today is someone who probably is good at math and considers the fight against autocorrect to be the great struggle of our time. It's the man known as Polymath. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, I think. So just to kind of get started with this whole thing, we were talking a little bit before we started recording here, talking about how like you're libertarian at heart, but you've gotten more socially conservative, and that's kind of where our trajectory has also gone. Because when we had first met, I think I was definitely the libertarian, and you're more the conservative. And then I kind of pulled you into that. Yeah. And then with the whole COVID thing and starting a family, that definitely changed our perspective on just politics and the real world in general.
Yeah.
So I guess in that regard, can you tell us about how your whole trajectory's changed?
Yeah. I mean, I still hold a lot of libertarian impulses, right? Like, I think freedom, especially from government, is better than most other options. But especially as I've become older, I've got more kids, I've watched a lot of the impulse to control people sort of shift from doing it with the government through doing it through corporations. And I think that's the thing that I don't like, is this impulse that people have to control other people, to tell them how to raise their children, to tell them what they should be doing in their religion, to tell them, like, there's a lot of that. A lot of the libertarian message has moved from, we want to get the government off your back, to we want to get the government off your back. And when you say, but the government's not my problem, it's actually the corporations. They're like, well, you got to leave those people alone because they need the freedom to do whatever they want to do. And if what they want to do is, you know, impose these insane rules on you for no reason, either through monopolies or products or to their employees, well, you just have to let them. And that a lot of that has come through with the COVID stuff. I think the vaccine mandate I think consumers should have been protected from a vaccine mandate that was coming from a corporate perspective, which is really a very frustrating thing to say, because you know, you get this line of argumentation where people are like, well, what about a vaccine mandate for healthcare workers? Well, like, here's the thing, before COVID, in theory, I would have been fine with that, right? Like, say, you know, you have to have your measles vaccination, you have to have your, you know, MMR vaccination, like, those are fine. But we ended up in this place where we're talking about a brand new vaccine, and it wasn't just healthcare, right? It was like retail sales, having these firing people because they didn't have their COVID vaccine. And like, I think people need protection from those kind of impulses, even if they're not coming from the government. And libertarians just have no answer for that. And that's good. A lot of it has come through. I think parents need a lot more help than they're getting in raising children from, and this is horrible, from society. It's really, really hard. I've got a 12-year-old daughter, a 12 and 10-year-old and 7-year-old. And I really could use a lot more cultural help in raising my children. Like, there are only so many TV shows that help reinforce the values that I'm trying to help them understand. And you know, kids just do. They just get so much of their values from stories, the stories they watch on television, the books that they read, the communities that they're in. And we've got a great church community, and we do our best as a family. But we need, you know, we do need help. We need some more reinforcement from more cultural points, because it's real hard to fight against.
Yeah, you talked about the COVID thing to kind of go with that, mm-hmm. and how, because I've seen people be talking about libertarians and how they don't have answers for things. And one of the things that reminded me of when you were talking about that was libertarians have no answer for social engineering. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of is probably putting it lightly, the whole COVID thing and how, oh, you have to have your vaccine, especially the COVID vaccine for sure. Like, you have to have that. And if you're not, then you're going to get fired and lose your livelihood and all that. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some libertarians that were definitely against that and definitely mm-hmm. anti-COVID vaccine mm-hmm. and all that. But there are other libertarians where they're saying, yeah, I see no problem with a business or a corporation, especially the government, being like, yeah, I mean, it's for the safety of the humanity, so we do need to do this. And it's just, how do you have these two groups of people who consider themselves this one ideology or philosophy or whatever you want to call it? It's kind of, I don't know, for me, it's frustrating. And when this type of social engineering that was happening, what are they going to do? Because that's just one aspect of it. And then in the future, if something like this happens again, how are they going to react to it? Are they going to react the exact same way? Is it
probably
just, yeah, honestly, it's going to be just a complete snowball effect.
I one of the things that I found, like, COVID was just so eye-opening for me, because everybody talks a certain talk. They have this vision of who they are and how they want other people to see them. And then when the stuff hit the fan with COVID, like, people really showed you what they really believed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who thought they were anti-government actually weren't as anti-government as they thought they were. They were actually pretty pro-government, doing things that, Neil Gorsuch called it, like, the greatest peacetime violation of civil liberties in the history of our country, right? And a lot of people just went along with it. And it was, to me, a fairly astonishing thing to see. And now to kind of revisit it, it's because you can't let an opportunity like that to actually show who you are pass you by and then claim that you were the person, right? You're the person who didn't act. Like, that was your chance. And I, like you said, some libertarians were good, but the group as a whole was not, that was not the people that everybody went to see what would my ideals and my ideology drive me to do in pursuit of freedom. That was so dispiriting.
Yeah, it was. And like you were saying, a lot of people wouldn't go to those that were against it. They would see the Cato's and then the Reason magazines. They would see those people. And yeah, I'm sure there were some that were involved with those places that were against it, but for the most part,
oh, yeah,
from what I've seen, and maybe I'm wrong, but from what I've seen, it was a lot of, you know, if the company wants to do it, then it's fine. You know, the whole private property, or not private property, but they're a private company, bro. They can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's like, okay, yeah, private property. Why are you saying private property? Private company. But it's just,
well, you did say you can't talk in the beginning.
I know. So I'm fulfilling that whole thing there. Because I know that we've seen some libertarians who they did consider themselves that. And then when all this happened, they went to this whole post-libertarian thing or whatever you want to call it. And then there were libertarians, well, you were never, like, kind of what you're saying, they were never real libertarian, but they were kind of in an opposite direction of,
mm-hmm. of I feel this. Like, it's a lot of drama for, like, a group of people that's pretty obscure. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
Most people don't, if you go out on the street, a lot of people don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
Right. I think there's a strain of libertarianism, and this isn't all of them, but there's a lot of them, who are basically just contrarians. Right. And so like, and they don't want to be conservatives and they don't want to be liberals. And so they can kind of latch on to this label, but they, like when, I don't know, like, I feel like none of this stuff, all the politics and all, I feel like now that none of it matters unless you can tell me what you're going to do with it. Right. Like, how are you going to, how is this actually driving? How are you living differently? How are you, what are you doing differently? And you know, I wouldn't have cared that much before COVID, but after COVID, I'm like, I see so many fractures. And one of the things that I like, I'm gonna stick on probably till I die. We'll see how long it lasts. Now that the COVID as a crisis is over, I'm really focused on what was the takeaway? What was the message on the elite control level about what happened? And what are the story they're telling themselves? What is the story they're trying to put into the history books? Because you can see them starting to put it into the history books. Mm-hmm. And just trying to be there to sort of say, no, what you're saying, like Randy Weingarten be like, oh, I was trying to get kids back into schools. Like, just don't stop doing that. Admit that you didn't want kids back in schools. Say that's a policy that you wanted. Then you can move forward. But don't do this. Don't pretend that you were someone you were not.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe just on Twitter, it seems like a lot of people are lying about how bad it was now. Or they're like, oh, it was just a couple months. You know, like nothing really happened.
Right, right.
Seriously? After all of that?
Yeah. Oh, I've been saying this since like the first 4 weeks into the crisis. It was like, there is going to be basically like a history revolution. There's going to be a real reckoning for what happened when the kids who are around 10 years old get into college. Because their professors are going to tell them a thing that happened and they're going to be like, that is not true. That I was there when it happened and you are lying to me about my own life. Like that, I think that is going to be big. And the other one is when they get to college and they meet people from other states and they realize how different things were from state to state. That's going to be really eye-opening for a lot of kids. And they're going to get up. They're going to get really mad about it.
I didn't even think of that because like the states, the responses to this were like hugely different. Like we were in Texas at the time and they kind of, I don't know about like our local government in Dallas, but they didn't really, like nobody really cared after a while. They just stopped using masks and they're like, whatever. Like I'm talking about like in July 2020.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I know in other places it continued for like years.
My kids did not go back to school full time in the 2020-2021 school year. They were out of school entirely until March. They went back for 2 days a week, two half days a week. We ended up getting to go back 4 half days a week by the end of the school year, but it was awful. They closed down businesses that refused to enforce the mask mandate. The one that I was really just begging libertarians to help me out with was when the state of Washington forced my daughter was doing gymnastics and she went to this great gymnastics place and it was done by some people in our church and the state was forcing the gymnastics business owners to enforce their vaccine mandate for children, which the business owners didn't believe in and didn't do for their own children. But the state said, if you don't enforce this, we're going to shut you down. And I'm like, if I can't get libertarians to back me up on that one, then that's a lost cause, my friends. Like they were forcing this guy to violate his conscience if he wanted to continue running his businesses. And they were forcing him to act as a police. He's not the police. He shouldn't have to be the police. That's what he signed up for. Anyway, I'm sorry. I did.
That's crazy.
I try to be more chill. I sometimes drink a little too much and I get on late and I get really unchill on Twitter. But I'm always embarrassed about it. But the one thing I'm not embarrassed about being unchill with is some of the things that happened during COVID, because that it went out. It was so wildly out of control.
Yeah, I think a lot of parents would be in the same boat with you, where they felt that, like, you know, their livelihoods were being ruined, and especially what was going on with their children, like you were saying. I mean, yeah, that's usually where they draw the line, is once you start dealing with the kids, that's it.
That's like a hard line.
Yeah, that's always a hard line.
Yeah, I got it. That's, I mean, it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine recently, an internet friend I had met for the first time, and he said that it was funny to watch me as the COVID crisis gone and my patience just got shorter and shorter. And I'm like, oh, it's a crisis. You know, we can all come together. We can work together. And he's like, I could just, you were getting like more and more frustrated and annoyed. And it was really funny to watch you, but he can say that because he lived in Florida, so he didn't have to deal with any of it. So I can see how it's funny from that perspective.
Florida was probably the most lenient state.
One of them for sure. Yeah.
More lenient than Texas.
Yeah. I am a huge Ron DeSantis fan, and it is entirely because I watched what was happening during COVID, and he really took a leadership role. He was clearly well educated on not just the science of what was happening with the disease, but what was going on within his own state. And I mean, I could talk for hours about all the policies that he did that nobody else was doing, but he looked at the data, and he looked at the, you know, what was happening, and he said, I think this is the correct course. We're going to do it. So, you know, some people talk about, like, he doesn't have enough charisma, and I'm like, I don't care about charisma if someone can govern effectively. Yeah. Right. And so.
Well, I believe when this whole thing started, I think he had done like mandates and lockdowns, whatever, but he realized after a little while, he's like, yeah, this isn't working out.
It was pretty early on.
Yeah, it wasn't like it was like 2 years later. It was, I don't know, it was a short
amount. Like 6 weeks. It was like by May.
Yeah.
He's like, this isn't right. Mm-hmm. But so talking about libertarians and how they're reacting and how your patience was pretty much running thin with them. I wanted to read one of your tweets that you talked about about it. So you had said that your experience with librarians, I know you meant, that's why I was joking at the beginning about autocorrect.
Yeah.
So my experience with libertarians is that they overthink their positions, preferring logic over real world human interactions. Women tend to lean more heavily on human experience over rote logical deduction, which is why they tend less libertarian. And I think with like the first paragraph of that, talking about preferring logic over real world human interactions, that's why a lot of them are like that online, like the online libertarian. That's like a thing.
Right. Yes. Where, right.
You know, you're saying all the stuff online,
but not doing anything in real life.
Offline, you're kind of just there, you know, you're kind of just one of the people. Right. And I mean, it's hard to just all of a sudden, because I mean, we know some people that they're going to start growing their own food, and they're going to not be completely off the grid, but definitely not as much on the grid as they were before. And that's definitely part of that whole lifestyle of being a libertarian and trying to be off away from the government as much as possible, out of the system. Right. Thanks.
Yeah.
But then there's some where you kind of be like, I don't know if a lot of this stuff. Because I've seen people say, well, anytime you have an interaction with someone, that's about as anarchist as you can get. Like you and I having this conversation, that's pretty, there's no like government person being like, hey, I want to know, what are you talking about over there? There's almost like standing right over there.
Not yet.
You know, like Mr. X or whatever, the cigarette smoking man from X-Files being like, you better watch what you're saying, bud. Which that's true. But then at the same time, the whole like living in Encapistan in your head. That's kind of what it is. You're living in this fantasy land in your head, but then in real life, it's like, okay, we're not going to get rid of all the stuff all out of the, like in 1 second, it's not going to happen.
I like a lot of the like homesteader types. And a couple of them are my good friends. I think the best ones are actually the Christians, the Catholics, the Orthodox ones. And part of it is that Libertarian tends to lean pretty heavily towards isolationism, like personal isolationism. Mm-hmm. It jives really well with the, like, you know, up by your bootstraps sort of attitude, which I have gotten way farther away from as I've gotten older. Mm-hmm. Because I think, like, I moved to Chattanooga from Seattle because my family's here. And it isn't just like I like my family, but like we can support each other, right? We can take care of each other's kids when somebody needs to do something. We can take care of others' pets when someone wants to take a trip. And it is like I dislike the sense that we have, and a lot of Americans have, of like, well, I can't ask anybody for help, right? Because that's like cheating. Right. I can't ask for help. Or, I mean, the real rough one for me, the very frustrating, is the people who won't ask their personal friends and their community for help, but will demand help from the government. Like, that blows my mind. Because that, like, that's not how we should be doing this. We should be coming together as a community. We should be helping each other out. And I've got a small group of, close friends who we're all kind of in tech. We do okay for ourselves, financially, but we're all in agreement that, like, the idea of amassing an enormous amount of wealth and then passing it on when you die is ridiculous. And we should be helping our kids when they need the help. We should be helping them out financially if that's what they need to start a family when they're young. You know, and not to a point where they're reliant on us. But like, if there's some big ticket item and the kid feels like they have to hit that thing before they can move forward in their lives, man, like, I hope my kid comes to me. I hope they don't try to do that on their own, because I would rather they get that jump start and get through that and, you know, start moving ahead. Because like finances when you're just starting out are very different from finances when you become stable. And a lot of people have a trouble making that shift between, mm-hmm. you know, between building up a nest egg and shifting into like growth investment when they're in their middle age, which is how old I am. But
you know what that reminds me of? I think it was you who tweeted this. I saw it on my timeline the other day, but there was like this tweet saying like, nobody should get, everything that you inherit should go like back to the government or something like that. And everybody was freaking out about it. Right. Then you were like, well, maybe I agree with this, because I think like everything that you inherit or what, like, you should do it while they're still alive.
You should. Yeah. My grandmother passed away about a year ago, and she spent the last 5 years of her life systematically giving all of her stuff away because, mm-hmm. and quite frankly, that was the best. That's a great idea. Because once you die, the legal process of giving your stuff away is fraught. It is an enormous pain in the butt. But if you give it away while you're living, while you're still alive, that's actually great estate planning. So, like, I mean, that was a bit of a troll, right? Mm-hmm. Because obviously not everyone can do that. But I you know, it's I'm gonna shift the topic, and hopefully it's in a good direction. But like, I think people should be orienting their view of most things in their lives around the idea of having a family. Elder care is a nightmare if you do not have a family. It is a nightmare. And it's actually a nightmare for your family if you don't have, if like, it's going to be harder the fewer children you have and easier the more children you have. Mm-hmm. Elder care is tough. And dying is very difficult for people. It's very difficult to die in a clean way. And you know, my church has been, I've been helping take care of an elderly couple, and their kids moved away. They have four kids. One is an absolute disaster ne'er-do-well, who is squatting with friends in their house. And they both have dementia. And it is just, and the kids who are away just don't know what's going on, right? And so the church has had to step in and help take care of these people. And the successful people, I mean, just solid middle-class family with four kids, but all their kids moved away except for the moocher. And the end result is that their living situation is chaos, right? And it's, they're sliding into decline in an assisted living facility, which at least we can, at least they can afford that.
Yeah.
Right. Because otherwise they'd be declining. I mean, they'd be rotting in their own home. Right. And they need people. They need someone to take care of them. And I don't see that a lot of people recognize how important it is to have family, and to have extended family is incredibly helpful to have around. And I think we should be orienting kids to understand that, and we should be orienting our society to support that.
You know, to go along with that, I feel like there's so many, maybe I just hear about it more often because of being online, but it seems like in the last couple of decades, a lot of people are just choosing not to have kids. And I feel like that's going to turn into a huge problem when everybody starts aging.
Yeah. Oh, like, it's going to get so bad. Yeah, just, I mean, things like this is already starting to happen, but it's going to get so much worse in about 20 to 30 years. Lost money. There are millions of dollars, and it will become billions of dollars of money that's in a bank account, and there's no understanding of who it should go to.
Wow. Right?
Like, because, and people will open a bank account, they'll open a stock, stock trading portfolio, they'll open all these. And either through dementia, like we've seen this happen through dementia, like guy can't remember his password, can't remember the account number, didn't save the receipts. And so he knows he has like $100,000 somewhere. Right. And a lot of that stuff you can find in probate, right? Like because there's like social security numbers attached to it, but you do have to go looking, right? And not everybody knows how to go looking, where to find it. And it's especially as people don't leave heirs, right? If they don't have a will, or they have people, or someone to execute it, that's, it's very sad. Mm-hmm.
We see that in other countries, like Japan and Korea, mm-hmm. where the birth rate is really low, and the senior citizens there are just dying off.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the young adults they're very business and career oriented. And I mean, the culture there, from my understanding of it, is that it's, like I was saying, it's very business oriented. Their whole life is revolved around their career and how much money they can make. And it's like a material world, basically, type of thing. And here in America, it's getting to that point, like she was saying, where, like, in the next decade, 20 years or so, like guys were saying, is that it's, because a lot of that culture that's been creeping in from, like, kids aren't important, or I don't want to have kids because I don't know if I want that responsibility. I don't like kids. They're annoying. It's like, raising a child is not easy. It's not like, just push a button and everything's going to be awesome, 100%.
Right.
And I think that's something that a lot of young people nowadays just don't understand. And I think, kind of like with us, like I was saying before, how we definitely changed our mindset on things is because once we had that, we started that family, it kind of makes you realize, it's not just about me. Because I saw someone, I don't remember who it was, I think it was one of your tweets that someone was replying to, where they were saying that, like having a child is the most selfish thing that you can do, which I was like, what are you talking about? The most selfless thing that you can do. Like, I think you wanting to have a kid, what are you, crazy? Like, that's so selfish of you. I was like,
I think this is probably a good pivot into the conversation on optimism, because people give reasons for not wanting to have kids, but the biggest one that I see is people are just pessimistic about the future. they just don't think the future is going to be very bright. And if it's not going to be very bright, why would you want to bring a kid into it? And I first of all, I disagree with that. I think even if you felt the future wasn't going to be very bright, the future is going to need people to help fix it, right? And those people are going to be kids. You know, there's actually a lot of opportunity in fixing things. But then you also have to believe that things can be fixed. So there's still that kernel of optimism has to be buried in there somewhere.
It's like taking a black pill, basically. Like,
yeah,
I don't want to have kids because the world's is a nightmare and it's gonna end. And yeah, I mean, the world's not perfect. There's definitely gonna be some bad days and things that you're seeing in politics or just in culture in general. You're just like, this is not good. But it, like I was saying before, it really depends on it's your responsibility to make sure that the path that your child and your children go through is a good one. That's what I was saying before in a previous episode, where I was like, from my personal view on it and how I feel about being a dad, it's something that I think about all the time, is that I don't want to screw this up. Like, I don't want to, and I know that there's other dads that probably think the same thing, and like hearing stories about, their son became this and their son became like a drug addict, and I'm just like, I don't want that to happen to me, because at any point you're thinking, did I do something wrong? Did I say something? And I'm not just saying like the completely obvious stuff where, yeah, that kid became this because the dad was just a piece of crap. Like, I get that. But someone that really tried their hardest and tried to be a good dad, but for whatever reason. And then
their kid became a serial killer.
Right, right.
Yeah. 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 I think one of the things I'm trying to help my kids see is that they're born to a specific time, right? A specific era. And that's going to have a big impact on what they can do and what they should expect out of life. But that they can take control of their future, and they can do things. They can do more things than they thought they could have. And the more you understand the space in which you live, the better you are going to be at adapting your attitude and your expectations to find success in that. And I define success very broadly, not just economic success, but like, finding yourself, finding a family, or, building a home, or there's a lot of really important ways that you find success as you grow up. So
I wanted to, we're talking about like optimism, and you had written a post on your Substack that was titled Resilient Optimism, which I highly recommend people go check it out.
Thank you.
So you had said that I don't see a lot of optimism these days, and I worry that I myself am not a reliable source of it. I spend a lot of time on Twitter, and the vibe there has become relentlessly negative, almost to the point of despair, which I think it's kind of become a joke now, where people say, I hate Twitter, it's an absolute cesspool. And guilty, all the time. So we're kind of being hypocrites here. But I think just that alone, like, social media is definitely, because it's kind of a weird conundrum, like a weird balance. Cause there are some good things about Twitter. Like, we met on Twitter, so that's like a positive there. A lot of people get their news from Twitter. They don't go to freaking CNN or Fox or wherever. They don't go to those websites. They go to Twitter to see what's going on in the world or whatever.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, people just arguing over like the dumbest stuff that does not mean anything in our lives.
Yeah.
And it's a weird balancing act. And to continue reading on, as you say that, I hate despair in the way that most people hate cancer. It's easy to fall into despair and hard to crawl out. It creeps into our lives through a daily trickle of bad news, slowly poisoning our hearts. It infiltrates our minds and changes our entire worldview, so that we perceive our world as inevitably hostile, however you want to say it, a place destined for suffering and pain. Then it waits for a trigger that can send us spiraling into an abyss, which, I'm going to kind of put that like how I am personally with that aspect of it, or that paragraph there. Like, I feel that, like I was saying about wanting to be a good dad and all that, that kind of gets me depressed, because even though I obviously have the control over it, it's still something that I, that's probably one of the things I think about the most in my life, is just the fact that I, like, it sounds stupid just talking about it out loud. Oh yeah, I get depressed because I'm worried that I'm gonna be a bad dad. You know, it's just weird to hear it now coming out of my mouth, but it's something that I think about a lot.
Yeah. And yeah. I think we need to, you know, this is sort of a Christian aphorism, but I think we need to guard our hearts against pessimism. And so, like, you can acknowledge that bad things are happening. You can be frustrated that bad things are happening, but you got to kind of like keep your heart back a little bit and protect it from some of that stuff, from some of, like, absorbing that as like a way of life. There are people, it's weird, because I want to say especially on the right, because I mostly see people on the right, but I think it is both ways. People are really have let some of that just creep in and infect their hearts, and they see the world as not just bad, but inevitably bad, unfixable in every way. And I believe the world is unfixable in the sense that there's always going to be sin, and the fight against that is constant, and, you know, and injustice and that sort of thing. But I think there's so much good to be done, right? To be discovered, to be created. There's so many people to help, right? And there's so many ways to put good things back into the world. And I really want to guard myself against thinking that the bad things are always there and they're always going to win. So I think that's, I talked a little bit in that article about going to Charleston, South Carolina, and to the American College of Building Arts, where the students are building, they get a bachelor's degree in timber framing or carpentry or, blacksmithing, wood carving, or stone carving, that sort of stuff. Very, very cool. It sounds like an art school. It acts like an art school, but everybody there has a job when they graduate. So that's not an art school, obviously, right? But it's a combination of, like, the kids there, and they're not all kids, but the people there know that they're doing something that has purpose. They're building something in real life, and somebody wants it, right? And they're so joyful and optimistic and, like, ready to get into the world and start making their mark and doing their thing. And I didn't mention this in the article, but over half of the graduating students were engaged to get married. Right. Like, they, and I think the optimism is a big part of that, is they're like, okay, I think I have a place in this world. And when I feel with that security, I feel like I can go start a family. I think that's so important that people, I think that's actually the starting place for a lot of the goals to sort of, like, improve our culture and our society, is to believe, is to have an optimism, a core optimism, believe that there's something tomorrow that you're excited about or looking forward to.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, it sounds like a trade school that you're kind of talking about. Where
it does, but the big difference between it and trade school is that it's kind of like the difference between a plumber and a master plumber, where you don't get to be a master plumber until you've done it for a certain amount of time. Well, in Europe, they still have apprenticeship master guilds. And so a lot of those students will, a lot of those people will start as apprentice, and they'll take 7 years to get to a guild level skill. And it involves a lot of book study, which is, I think it's a really big difference between the trade school and this. Is that the students they're more like architecture students than they are like plumber, electrician type trade school stuff. And they're very, the stuff they build is remarkable. It is artistically incredible stuff. And, uh, And it was very encouraging to see that, just because I personally know some kids who are like, they're, you know, getting to upper high school and they're like, I don't know what I want to do. Right. Like, I don't want to go to college. Some of the ones I feel very sad. Some of them are like, I'm not smart enough to do math or science. And I'm like, no, you are. Stop doing that to yourself. But there's, I mean, part of the difficulty there is that, like, you do need to believe that you're smart enough to do that stuff in order to do that stuff. Otherwise you're not gonna be able to do it.
Yeah. Right.
Like, if you, I mean, if I didn't think I could do math, I would not have gotten through my math classes. Right. Like, I would have stopped because I got frustrated, because I hit a wall and I wouldn't have worked through the wall. I would have been like, oh, I guess I just can't do this. But yeah.
And that's an important thing that you're talking about, how a lot of high schoolers coming out, not knowing what they want to do. And you see some of these people that go into college for just stuff that you're like, how are you going to get a job with this? Yeah. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So at least with what the kids that you're talking about, at least there's something that they can actually see. Like, yeah, I'm actually going to be doing something at the end of this.
Right.
And then, like I mentioned with trade school, that's another where they can actually see, yeah, I'm going to become a welder, I'm going to become an electrician. Mm-hmm. That's something that's important for the world. Like, yep. We need plumbers. Mm-hmm. We need people who can build houses. We right. need that. And not someone that's going to be a freaking teacher for gender studies or whatever. That's yeah. like the prime example of it. It's just,
come all on, those really. People end up in HR though. Let's be real.
That, yeah. That, yeah. yeah. That's probably true.
Yeah. I'm not an HR fan.
Yeah, me either.
It's, there's so much, or, I don't know. There's so much friction in a lot of corporate structures. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see some sort of revolution within corporate America that's basically like, we have too much friction, we should have less friction. So,
and what do you think would be a kind of a good way to really start that, to where there's not as much friction as there is now?
I am not entirely sure. I lost my job a couple of weeks ago, and I'm looking at some new positions. One of them is with a consultancy, and the consultant, I kind of like consultancies, because the good ones will jump into a company and they have a very defined task. And the reason their task is defined is because the company does not want to pay them forever, right? Because mm-hmm. the company can stop paying them at any time, more or less. I mean, within the bounds of the contract, but right. And to that end, I like the projects that this company has found, because they're discrete tasks, right? This one's a 3-month project. This one's a 6-month project. The other one is I'm looking at a startup, and the startup looks like it might be fun because they don't have that friction yet, but they don't have that friction. Everybody needs to be able to talk to everybody else. Because if you don't, you're not going to move fast enough. You're not going to get enough stuff done. We need to hit these client requirements, and we need to be able to ship this product. And I'm looking forward to that. I see a lot less friction with smaller organizations. And a lot of the larger organizations, I think that friction comes honestly through like legal, an attempt to sort of protect yourself legally from, employee interactions that might be hostile or something like that. It's gone too far. there are too many people in most organizations not doing enough stuff. And you know, there are good and bad things about Elon Musk, but I think his decision to fire like 2/3 of Twitter was the right one. I think most of his bad decisions with Twitter, actually what I'll call positive bad decisions, is like, he didn't have to make that decision. He chose to make that decision. It's not a result of him firing anybody or not having enough people to staff something. He just he talked about making it so that you can't DM between two people who aren't following each other, which I find ridiculous. That's stupid.
I didn't hear that one.
He mentioned it offhand, and then people started panicking about it. So maybe he's made a couple of those decisions. None of those decisions have anything to do with how many people work at Twitter. Hmm. Right.
Just and, what he decided, I guess.
Right. Yeah. He just decided, and then he found some people. He found whatever team that needs to implement that thing, and they implemented the stupid thing. Right. But I think it's gone to show, like, Twitter, it runs. It's still running. Right. Like, it's not. I think they probably have more video on it now than they did before. Because people with blue checks can put up entire movies if they want to.
Yeah.
And so, like, the throughput of Twitter is probably up, even though they let 2/3 of the staff go. So it's like, what were they doing?
Yeah.
I'm an Elon Musk fan, but I don't like to talk about it very much because it's kind of like, I don't know. He does say crazy things on Twitter. And it's funny because, like, I've said this a couple times that I'm like, I don't always like who I am on Twitter. And I have an alt account, which I like a lot more, because I'm so much more chill on the alt.
Basically, just like how I am too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, and there's a lot of times with Twitter where, like, people, I'll try to have a conversation with them, and, like, other people will jump into the conversation. I'm like, get out of here.
Yeah.
No, go away. I'm not talking to you. I like my long form writing. Like, so my Substack is much better. He's the person I would want to interact. Is the guy who writes my Substack, not the guy who tweets.
Yeah. Which is kind of weird now because, like, Substack links on Twitter.
Yeah, aren't they, like,
they're like something? They don't. I don't know. I guess it's something with the algorithm. Yeah, the algorithm kind of suppresses. Yeah.
I think that was such a bad move on Musk's part. Because Substack was where Twitter users, like, that's how Twitter users made money. Like, they really first started making money when they got a Substack and they went to Substack, and then their Twitters and Substacks would be pretty intricately linked. And here's the funny thing is, if I felt I would be happy to pay Twitter advertising revenue, if I felt that Twitter could help push my Substack, I've already got an existing publishing relationship over there. Help me build that up to more people. I can make more money. I'll give Twitter a chunk of that money. I'm happy to, if I can increase my reach. But I'm not starting a new newsletter on Twitter. Or if I do, it's just going to be a mirror of the Substack. Like, everybody who's over at my Substack, that, like, I don't want to say they're all my good friends. That's pretty presumptuous, but they like me, right? Like, they like reading what I do. I've got a lot of my friends are over there, and it would feel disloyal to be like, oh, sorry, now you got to go over here to read all my stuff. So
I feel that the whole, subscribe, I think some people would probably, because I feel like that's probably what Elon wants to happen, is he wants people to not use Substack, and he wants to use that subscription
thing on Twitter.
Subscription thing where, oh, you pay $4 a month or whatever it is to read this special long thread or whatever that I would have put on Substack, but I want it on Twitter. And I think Substack's now trying to make their whole format look almost identical to Twitter. They're trying to be like competitors now, where, and that might be the reason why he did that, was because, well, if you're going to do that, well, screw Substack,
right?
Have Twitter be the place where you can post whatever you want, post as however long videos that you want.
Right.
And I don't know what the ultimate goal for that is, but that's what I would probably think it would be.
Twitter and Substack need to be partnering. They don't need to be competing against each other.
Right.
They're different things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So I guess we can end it there. So let people know where they can find your work and where they can find you on social media and anything else you'd like to plug.
So yeah, you can read me at polymath, polimath.substack.com. And I'm on Twitter at politicalmath. But if you search polymath, I'll show up there too. Those are the two main places. If you think hard enough, And you follow me long enough, you'll figure out what my alt is. And you're welcome to follow me over there. I do approve pretty much everybody, but I'm not giving it out because it's a much calmer place than I would like it to remain. So.
Yeah, I don't give out my alt either, so I don't blame you.
Right. But yeah, you can figure it out if you follow me long enough. So, but yeah, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for coming on and having a conversation with us.
Yeah.
It's a lot different than, you know, tweeting back and forth.
Right. It is a bit. So, good luck to you guys. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on. Hopefully we'll do this again sometime. And for everyone watching, listening, please tune in next time. Our guest will be Alan Mosley returning back to the show, the host of It's Too Late with Alan Mosley. So looking forward to that. And we will see you then. Bye. The truck's backing up because they're hearing us. I think it's time to end this episode.
And smash that like button.
Yeah, smash that like
button. Just break your computer.
And don't forget to subscribe. Hit that subscribe button.
Bye.
Bye.